Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Over the last 5 years, California has experienced its worst drought since at least the 70s. During the drought, thousands of California residents' taps have gone dry, while Big Ag has brought in record profits. So what explains this? The new documentary, Water and Power, A California Heist, reveals how private companies rewrote the rules and seized control over the state's water supply. Journalist and author Mark Arex lays out what we're facing.
There's probably no landscape in the world that has been more manipulated than California. From the very beginning, it was about capturing water and moving it from where it was to where it wasn't. Because of that manipulation of water, a great civilization has risen. We've created two world-class cities, Los Angeles, San Francisco. And in the middle, we created the most fertile farm belt the world's ever known. But the growth of suburbia, the growth of agriculture, and the demands of the environment, all those things are putting immense pressure on this system. And the system has started to crack. They've been pumping and pumping and pumping from these aquifers that have taken hundreds, if not thousands, of years to build up. Water has become gold to be traded and sold. Extracting it in the same way. But it's not enough. The more water we need, the more water we will always need.
And that is journalist and author Mark Arex in the new documentary, Water and Power, A California Heist. It reveals how private companies have rewritten the rules and seized control over California's water supply. The documentary will air on National Geographic, and you can watch a trailer on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today's guest, Adam Keats, is featured in the documentary. He works on water supply and water privatization issues. He's currently litigating several cases regarding water privatization in California, including a major fight to reverse the privatization of the Kern Water Bank. That's one of the world's largest water banking facilities. Adam Keats is an attorney with the Center for Food Safety, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Adam. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose. Great to be here.
Wow. I learned so much from this documentary. I mean, we've done so many shows about the drought and about water, but this documentary revealed a lot of new information. So thanks for being in it, and thanks for sharing this.
Yeah, I mean, for me, this is I spent 7 years learning this stuff myself, and it's obtuse, it's dense, there's a lot there. I'm blown away that they were able to put this into an hour and a half and actually have it be remotely understandable. It's pretty big job.
Well, and one of the things that you said in the film really grabbed my attention. You said that only the sickest and most depraved lawyer would want to take on the water fight in California.
When I think one of my first hearings in this case, I showed up and one of the older lawyers on the opposite side said to me, "Oh, you know, you have kids? Well, you know, this isn't going to be over. Your kids are going to be in college before this is over." And I laughed it off. I said, I move fast. You know, don't worry. You know, I'm not in this for the money. I'm not in this for the career. I'm in this to take care of the problem." But 7 years later, I'm starting to think that might be true.
You also said that major water players, and we'll talk about those players throughout the show, and politicians have made water policy in California as complicated as they possibly can in order to keep people like you, a lawyer who works on these issues, from messing with their system.
Right. I mean, and that comes up so frequently. It comes up in the writings and in the briefs that they file. You know, I file my brief, and then there's a tone of a condensation, and it's you know, in oral argument, they'll say, you know, well, ha 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 ha, you know, Mr. Keats doesn't really understand what's going on here, or Mr. Keats got this wrong, or the petitioners or the plaintiffs got they don't really understand how complicated this is and how much all the nuances here. That's a very, you know, oh, it's a naive perspective, but the real world operates like this. And you know, part of my job and my organization's job is to say, you know, no, actually, you're living in a false reality that you've created yourself, and just because, you know, you've convinced yourself that it's true doesn't mean that that's the way the world should work. We think the world should work a different way, and we're going to be pushing until we accomplish that.
Well, let's just talk a little bit about how the state is made up, because I think the film does such a good job. More than two-thirds of the rain falls in Northern California, but almost two-thirds of the population lives in Southern California. And then you've got the middle, the Central Valley, which has the richest agricultural area in the world. Even though, talk a little bit about Kern County, for example, no groundwater there.
Right. With the western part of
Western
Kern County.
Part.
Yeah, the western part of Kern County is no groundwater, and it has traditionally not been good farmland at all. So when we think of the Central Valley as the incredible farmland that it is, historically it has excluded this section of western Kern County. That is now, you know, is now become the recipient of a tremendous amount of this state water that's being shipped in from the north.
So we've got 50% of water going to Los Angeles, where two-thirds of our population live, and then 25% goes to the west side of Kern County. And 90% of the world's almonds are grown there, 98% of all pistachios, 91% of all strawberries, and 88% of grapes.
Right. It's huge. I mean, and important thing to know about the almonds and pistachios and a lot of these crops, 85%, I forget the number, are exports. These are not for consumption within the United States. So we talk about feeding the United States and providing all the food that we need for the United States, but most of these crops that are grown in southern San Joaquin Valley are grown commodity crops grown for export.
Okay, so we'll get to that later. But so the west side of Kern County was turned into prime agricultural land, but because there's no groundwater there, it depends on the state's water program.
Exactly. And on the State Water Project, which is one of the largest state-built infrastructure projects in the history of the country. It's a tremendous project. Lake Oroville, that was in the news lately, which is the dam that was having problems with the spillway, that's part of the State Water Project system. There's a huge amount of water is shipped from the north to the south through the State Water Project. The second one is the Central Valley Project. It's smaller. That's the federal program. And the two are kind of, you often see photos of two canals kind of running down the center of farmland in the Central Valley. Those are the two main aqueduct shipping the water south.
And so talk a little bit about this water project and who actually had a seat at the table.
Yeah, well, you mean the Monterey Amendment?
The Monterey Amendment.
Right. So back in the 60s when they were proposing the State Water Project, and this is Governor Pat Brown, Jerry Brown's dad, he had to sell this to the north. The north was not convinced that it was a good idea to be building a giant system to ship all this water down to the south. And so he had to sell it to the north, and he said, look, we're going to implement all these – we're going to ensure that this system is based on a sustainable model. It's on an equitable model. We're going to have all these checks and balances that are going to make sure that some interests don't gain too much power, that everyone's voice is still heard in the operation of the system. In the 90s, things had changed dramatically. I think that coinciding with the rise of a privatization model in other industries, it's right around the same time as Enron and the privatization of energy in the state, they were looking at a way of more efficiently managing this resource, this project. And so they got together, and there was a feud between Los Angeles and Kern County that was about trying to divide the spoils, you know, whether more water should go to the cities, more water should go to the farms. And specifically, when we talk about Los Angeles, we're talking about the Metropolitan Water District of Southern California. They actually provide water to Los Angeles, San Diego, the Inland Empire. It's a huge water wholesaler. It's not just the city of LA or the county of LA. And then when we're talking about ag, we're mainly talking about Kern County and a couple of the counties right in that area, Tulare County, Kings County, mainly southern San Joaquin Valley, large-scale corporate agribusiness. They're basically fighting over how to divide the spoils of the State Water Project. So they got together in the mid-90s, and in a secret deal in Monterey, in the city of Monterey, that became known as the Monterey Agreement. And they basically said, you know what? What's getting in the way, what's creating our conflict are all these checks and balances that are designed to ensure equity and sustainability and, you know, public participation and public awareness of what's happening. These are actually the real problem. This is what's causing us to fight amongst each other. Why don't we just get rid of those things? And then we'll just figure out how to divide up the rest after we've eliminated these obstacles.
And so tell us a little bit about water banking and how that works.
Yeah, so a component of this is that in Kern County, they over the course of 100 plus years, they had depleted their groundwater aquifer. And this is just, you know, like any aquifer anywhere, it's a large, you know, freshwater supply that's underground water. When they sucked all that water out, it left in that area it left a cavity. They could put water back in, and the soils were such that they could lay water on the surface of the ground, and then that water would percolate through the soil and then refill the aquifer. It's sort of a combination of an empty aquifer and the right type of soil above it to allow the water to percolate down. They had that there, and the state went in and spent $72 million to purchase the land above the aquifer and to build up the infrastructure to be able to create this facility to recharge the aquifer, and created what's now known as the Kern Water Bank. And that's the idea: is you put your water in when you have a lot of water, and when it's dry, you can take it out when you're in a time of need.
And why was the Kern Water Bank created? Who was behind that?
Yeah, who was behind it was the state. It was back pre-90s when the state was running the state water project. A critical component of the state's management of these resources for the benefit of the whole state was they recognized they had a problem with south of the Delta storage. There was only one storage facility, San Luis Reservoir, south of the Delta, that the state was in control of and ran. And they wanted to diversify their storage ability and make, you know, increase. And we hear about it now all the time. We need more storage. This was an effort by the State Department of Water Resources to create that storage and allow the flexibility within the system, basically.
And in the documentary, we learn that the Kern Water Bank is controlled by Roll International. And a journalist wanted to get information about the Kern Water Bank and was basically hung up on. So he decided to go there. And when you get to the address where the Kern Water Bank is supposed to be, there's a sign that says the Paramount Farming Company, not Kern Water Bank. The Kern Water Bank is supposed to be a public entity, right?
Right. It is officially a public agency. It's a joint powers authority made up of 52% owned by public water districts and 48% by a private company. But in all practice and in effect, because of the control of those water districts by large agriculture companies, primarily Roll International, Roll International has a controlling share and basically has absorbed and controls the Kern Water Bank.
So as an attorney, are you able to get information from the Kern Water Bank? How transparent?
Yeah, that's a great question. We early on in this lawsuit back in 2010, 2011, we did a series of Public Records Act requests, and they are subject to the Brown Act and the Public Records Act. And so the Kern Water Bank Authority and the four other water districts that make up the 52% ownership are all subject to Public Records Act. And so we went down to their offices and looked at their documents. There's a big giant piece of the management of the Kern Water Bank Authority that we could not see. And that, we believe, and I still believe it, was hidden intentionally, or I'm sure it was intentional, but whatever it was operated through the 48% that was private. We can't get the documents from the 48% private owner of the Kern Water Bank. So you can imagine, like, let's say if they're going to do a private resale of water for profit. You can run that through one of the water districts, and then you're going to be exposed to Public Records Act requests that you have to disclose that. But if you run it through your private company that's within the Kern Water Bank Authority, all of a sudden you can hide that information. You can hide it very easily. So we have still, 7 years later, don't have documents showing the transactions that the Westside Mutual Water Company, the 48%, you know, this is the Roll International entity that the 48% control the Kern Water Bank, what they've been doing with their share of the water bank. And I think that's where the nasty stuff's happening.
And so what role did politicians have in this entire deal?
Well, in order for this to get done in the first place, the politicians have to be on board with it. But for the most part, initially, this was a rogue agency controlled by its customers, by the water districts. The rewriting of this thing was done by the contractors, and it was signed off to, I'd say, passively by the State Department of Water Resources. To the extent that politicians were, I would say they played more of a passive role than an active role. It's still offensive, but it was more passive.
Today, we are speaking with Adam Keats. He is an attorney with the Center for Food Safety, and he is featured in the new documentary, Water and Power, A California Heist. It'll air on National Geographic. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. This documentary takes a look at how private companies have rewritten water rules in California and have seized control over the state's water. Now, we're talking about the Kern Water Bank, which is controlled by Roll International. The sign outside says Paramount Farming Company. And I'm guessing that a lot of people have never heard of Paramount Farms. It's in Lost Hills, which is a predominantly Latino town. It's a very impoverished town. And we'll talk about the residents of that town and their connection with the farm. But Paramount Farms got a 58% slice of the Kern Water Bank. And again, this is one of the largest water banks in California. And in the film, there's so many attorneys and activists who are quoted, and they say that this was really a gift from the people of California to Stuart Resnick.
Right. I mean, Stuart and Linda Resnick are the owners of Roll International, now called The Wonderful Company, and that's the parent company of Paramount Farms. And this is a multinational, not a multinational, multi, it's an American-based, singularly owned company, but they are all over the world in their interest. They own Fiji Water, they own Teleflora, they own Palm Wonderful, they own Halo's Mandarins. You know, they have a whole ton of products that we know of are all under this brand, basically. And they're very successful, very successful.
And so the company is now called The Wonderful Company?
Right. They changed the name to The Wonderful Company, yeah. They're very good marketers. There's no question. You got to give them credit.
And we've heard a little bit about Stuart Resnick. We've done shows over the years. But Stuart Resnick, we learn in this film, started purchasing large swaths of land in Western Kern in the 70s. And again, no groundwater in this part of the state. And he had a vision to move California's water from where it was to where it wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us more about Stuart Resnick and how he got involved in, you know, growing this massive empire.
Yeah, well, one of the things that the movie does that I think is really interesting is actually gets it from his voice and his intent, what he was doing when he was buying this land. And I've always wondered, how much did he know what he was going to be able to do? Did the water come first? Did the land come first? Like, what was the order of business here? And it, by based on the movie kind of suggests, I think based on his words, that he was looking for a place to park his money. I mean, he had all these other business interests. He needed to have some sort of investment vehicle. Land was cheap in that area because there was no groundwater. And there were a lot of degraded oil fields there. So the oil had tapped out. And so there were oil companies and other, you know, failed farms that were looking to just dump the land, basically. So, and I think he realized he had political connections. I'd say that you have to look at him as thinking, I could probably make something out of this thing that where other people have failed, maybe I can succeed. And he very astutely realized right away the State Water Project is the way to get the water. And if he can get in on this negotiation, if he can get in on this big feud between the farmers and the cities and stuff, and he can somehow squeak in there, make things work for them, and then grab the biggest prize, which is the Kern Water Bank, he'd be in, you know, hog heaven. And that's literally what happened.
Well, how did he manage to do that? Because he was not at that Monterey meeting, but his main waterman had a major role at the meeting.
Right.
How did they manage to do this?
Well, he controlled several of the water districts that were subcontractors or recipients of State Water Project water already. So,
okay, can you explain how that works?
Yeah, so in California, we don't have in much of the country, our water districts, our public water agencies are very often one-acre, one-vote water districts. So if you create, and this is happening now as we speak with our groundwater legislation, people are creating these water districts to become, you know, public agencies. If you create them and you own all the acreage of the land within that district boundary, you effectively, you know, you get to appoint the board of directors of that district, and the district does your bidding. Mm. So he had one of them called Dudley Ridge Water District. It's essentially, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's vast majority of it is controlled by Roll International, and so he was receiving State Water Project water through that district already, and he had interest in other water districts in the southern San Joaquin Valley also. He already was a player at that point. He was buying land, you know, in some places where there was water being delivered by the state, and he was buying land where there wasn't water, and he was moving his water over. You know, he was playing the water game at that point.
Stuart and Linda Resnick have a net worth of $4.2 billion. And as you said, now the company is called The Wonderful Company. They own Fiji Water, Palm, that pomegranate juice, And in the film, we see a video of him sitting next to Hillary Clinton. They've given money to Democrats and Republicans, so they are major players in politics now.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, they're close to Dianne Feinstein. They are Democratic. They're generally Democratic donors. They are big arts philanthropists in the LA area. Politicians love them because they throw money around like crazy. And they do some, you know, they do cultural and arts donations and stuff. I mean, they're very well-known people in Los Angeles and state of California.
Well, and in the film, we learn that they have spent, $15 million on 2,500 residents of Lost Hills. Mother Jones wrote about this. About 600 people in the town of Lost Hills work for the Resnicks. And again, this is a predominantly Latino town. The film takes us basically down a street in Lost Hills, and it's very impoverished. People are living in homes that are very old, and in many cases, the people who live in this area do not drink the water where they live.
Right. I mean, very few people drink the water, I think, down there. And we saw that in the film. It just doesn't taste good. It's heavily chlorinated. It's from contaminated or not contaminated, but just not very high quality groundwater sources compared to the water that the farms are getting from the State Water Project. And the film kind of contrasts that. What's interesting is that the film is showing Lost Hills now. This is after the wonderful company went in there and spread all that money around to spruce it up. And they did that in response to the second great article or another great article by the journalist John Gibler, who wrote the first sort of expose of this whole thing called Water Heist. And that was back in 2003. He went back down and wrote another one called Lost in the Valley of Excess. And that is you can get both those online. It's a great piece describing that contrast of how the workers and how their communities are suffering compared to the wealth generated by the company and how the wealth is all going to Beverly Hills and going to these people that are in the top, these guys they're flush.
And in the film, we learn that the Resnicks have been very quiet. They don't give many interviews, but once we started really experiencing a major drought, the media started asking questions, and they painted the Resnicks in a pretty bad light. And so they decided to fund sidewalks, parks, playing fields, a preschool, and a health clinic in this area.
Exactly.
Where people are not drinking their own water. They're drinking bottled water.
Right.
They're using bottled water to shower and clean their dishes and their clothes.
Right, right. I mean, there's a little bit of that. There's the people that are using the bottled water for showering and cleaning their clothes. They're actually in a slightly different
in Porterville.
They're Porterville, exactly, in East Porterville, yeah, which actually ran out of water. The people in they actually their groundwater was completely taken by agriculture, and they just couldn't turn the taps on. The folks in Lost Hills just have low quality water, and so they're stuck drinking the bottled water.
Well, you mentioned John Gibler, and he's in the film. He's
yep.
an investigative journalist, and we will hear a clip with John in just a second. He says that the farm workers do not have water to drink, but the trees have plenty of water.
The myth is that as the agribusinesses benefit, the communities benefit.
How's the water at the school? Do you guys drink the water at the school?
No.
It tastes like blood?
It tastes nasty.
Nasty. It tastes like oxygen.
But in the case of the Resnicks, even with their, slideshow ready charity, no, you see that the Resnicks, jump up the Forbes list of billionaires and the workers can't even drink their tap water. And the ironies couldn't be sharper because the California Aqueduct literally flows through town, delivering high-quality, dirt-cheap, subsidized Northern California rainwater to the fields of Paramount Farming. But it's not an aberration in the system. It's the whole model. It's not designed or geared to build communities and to treat people well. It's designed and geared to make money.
That's a great point.
And that is a clip from the documentary Water and Power, A California Heist. This documentary reveals how private companies rewrote the rules and seized control of California's water supply. This documentary will air on National Geographic. You can take a look at the trailer at yourcallradio.org. And in the film, we also learn that the filmmakers tried to get an interview with the Resnicks, but they declined their request.
Right. That's every article that I've read and that I've been in part of, you know, and he mentions, you know, at some point, you know, Forbes and Business Week, they've all looked into this issue and they've all had no success in getting him to talk about this. There was one quote very early on in, I think, 2010 or so, where he said, what's the problem? We bought it. We own it. And I think since then, I think he's realized, wait a minute. Oh, yeah, sorry. People still think that's a public, you know, a public agency there, right? And he has had to catch himself since then.
And that is Adam Keats. He's an attorney with the Center for Food Safety, and he is featured in the documentary saying that only the sickest and most depraved lawyer would want to take on the water fight in California. But here he is in California in the studio. You're still doing it.
Still doing it. Well, luckily I have the support of Center for Food Safety. I've been very lucky to have, you know, nonprofit support. This would be impossible as a private lawyer. You have to be part of an organization that's willing to fund this type of thing.
We're going to take a quick break. If you have any questions or comments about water in California, the privatization of water, and how these rules got rewritten to the point where 50% of water goes to LA, 25% goes to the west side of Kern County, Paramount Farms now has a 58% slice of the Kern Water Bank, one of the largest water banks in California. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
You're listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, the documentary being discussed today, Water and Power, a California Heist, will re-air on National Geographic Sunday, June 25th at 8 p.m. Pacific Time. Tomorrow on Your Call, how does the pretrial and bail bond system embolden predatory practices? Of the approximately 700,000 people in jail on any given day in the United States, more than 60% have not even been sentenced. The majority of prisoners in local jails are serving time because they can't afford to pay the pretrial bail bond. Since the 1980s, pretrial detentions have far outpaced the number of individuals actually serving sentences. Join the conversation on the next Your Call at 10 a.m. tomorrow with Renee Kemp and you. And on Wednesday on Your Call, we'll have a conversation with CIA specialist Mel Goodman about his book Whistleblower at the CIA, an insider's account on the politics of intelligence.
Next idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we are talking about a new documentary called Water and Power, a California Heist. It looks at how private companies rewrote the rules and seized control over California's water. It'll air on National Geographic on March 14th, and you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Adam Keats is featured in the documentary. He's an attorney with the Center for Food Safety. As Adam says in the film, major water players and politicians have made water policy as complicated as they possibly can in order to keep people like him from messing with their system and really to prevent average people from understanding our water supply. I mean, this is a massive state, but still, it's really difficult to describe how the water system works in a nice soundbite.
Right. Even
in an hour show,
yep,
it's difficult.
Exactly.
Let's talk.
I'm not going to try.
No, thank you. We're going to do the best we can. But again, the one thing that's so interesting in this film is it looks at the west side of Kern County, which has no groundwater. It's totally dependent on the state's water program. 88% of grapes are grown in California, the world's grapes, 91% of strawberries, 98% of pistachios, 99% of almonds. And as you said, the majority are exported. So how many or what percentage of these almonds and pistachios are grown on the west side of Kern County?
I wish I had that stat. And the majority of almonds and pistachios and tree crops in California are grown in the southern San Joaquin Valley. There's about five or six different counties that are major players. The five largest almond-producing counties are in southern San Joaquin Valley. But we grow almonds and pistachios statewide. And there are, for 100 years or so, we've been growing almonds and pistachios and other nut trees in the Sacramento River Valley, which is north of the Delta. Those tree crops have been grown essentially dry farmed, which means rainwater, and then supplementing with groundwater, and have been, I would say, as close to sustainable as you can get for crops.
So this is important because when we were in the middle of our drought, there was this fight between people writing about meat and dairy and then people saying, oh, but all of you vegetarians and vegans drinking your almond milk are killing the state's water supply.
Right.
And they didn't make a distinction between, for example, almonds grown in the west side of Kern County versus almonds grown in Chico.
Right, exactly. And they also didn't make a distinction about the fact that the vast majority of the new almond plantings, the southern San Joaquin Valley, and all the increase in this in demand has not been American demand. It's foreign. These are export crops now. The almond milk and silk, you know, almond company or whatever, you know, milk company is not driving the demand that's we've experienced here in California. 85% of the almonds produced in California are exported primarily to Asia. And there's just what's happening, and this is said in the film at one point, it needs to be recognized you can grow almonds elsewhere in the world. And people who can grow almonds elsewhere in the world are realizing, it's actually cheaper to have California grow them and use their water, and let's use our water for something more valuable, more interesting, more beneficial to people, or whatever it is. The exportation of crops from California worldwide is mostly the exportation of water, which is, if you think about it, why are we doing that? We have a huge problem with water in this state. Why are we selling it internationally when we could be and we need to be using it ourselves?
Right. And a lot of people in the film say it does not make sense to grow almonds in the desert.
Right.
As someone who buys almonds, how do we know whether the almonds we're buying are grown in the desert or are grown in a sustainable manner?
Yeah, at this point, it's almost impossible, unfortunately. Wow. The Resniks have vastly controlled the processing facilities and the distribution networks such that I'd say unless you can find farmers market, organic, locally grown, you know where they're grown, and you have some sort of direct chain right now, I just simply don't trust any of the large-scale commodity almond resellers. It's just the Resniks are and the San Joaquin Valley interest, they're mixing them all up too much. You can't guarantee you're not getting those almonds.
And what effect have the Resniks had on small farmers?
They've been devastating. I mean, there are stories of them because once they started controlling the water, and when we say Resniks, I mean, it's like, you know, we really should say
the company.
Yeah, the wonderful company.
The company that's run by the Resniks.
Yeah, Stuart might not have been doing this himself. Might have been his agents. But one of the things they did is they used their market control of the water supply to force smaller farms to use their own processing facilities. So there was a lawsuit a few years ago by a competing processing facility that had been, you know, in operation for a long time that had all of its clients drying up. And the clients were saying, well, I'd love to keep coming to you, but I'm getting my water from my water district, and they said that I was going to stop getting water if I didn't use Paramount's processing facility. So we're talking about a vertically integrated company that's using its control to establish greater and greater market dominance.
We have an email from Catherine who says, a Delta farmer who I know told me and Gray Brecken, who works at UC Berkeley on these issues, several years ago that a major investor in Paramount Farms is Bloom Capital Management, Richard Bloom and his wife Diane Feinstein. Paramount also has interest in the Delta and owns some of the property, which will have to be taken under eminent domain if the Delta Tunnels project goes through. This is part of the way private companies control water politics and distribution in California. It's often done through shell companies whose names have nothing to suggest who is really behind their control.
I don't know enough about Bloom's connection to Paramount, but absolutely this is discussed in the movie. It comes out really well. I mean, in the bad actor in the movie is Harvard's endowment fund, which is really interesting, and this is over in the Paso Robles area. But absolutely, the idea of using these shell companies and using investment vehicles to acquire land and to create the pressure that then ends up forcing state policy decisions. I mean, that's like these are you have farmers saying we need more water, but you realize this is actually part of a, I'd say, an almost a coordinated game about, you know, acquiring the land, creating the demand, creating the pressure, creating the political pressure, and then the right hand and left hand start doing stuff together.
Can you tell us more about what's happening in Paso Robles and why we should be paying attention to that?
Yeah. So what we noticed in, you know, Kern County is kind of past tense. We're still fighting it, and we want to reverse it. And we have active lawsuits. We have an active appeal and an active trial court lawsuit right now against that whole Kern Water Bank stuff and the State Water Project. But it did start in the it took place in the 90s, and we have 25 years, you know, whatever it is, of hardening of that whole experience. that the same players who were active in that one and are active in other efforts of privatization in the state have been targeting their attention in the Paso Robles area. This is in the southern half of the San Luis Obispo County. It's known for its wine right now, for its brewery. It's got a lot of family farms and small wineries. And there have been large-scale industrial agriculture interests buying up vegetable crops and vineyards, family vineyards and vegetable crops, and wholesale conversion to wine grapes. There's a massive wine grape boom there. Now, you can say, you could start and stop it there, saying, well, it's just a wine thing, and these guys are all getting in for the wine. But the location of a lot of the purchases, what we started looking at and started realizing, and the local activists have been leading the charge in this, they're all located above the strategic areas which appear to be pretty good for water banking. And they're also right near the spur line of the State Water Project Aqueduct, the line that goes down to Santa Barbara. And so if you combine the geologic benefit of, you know, that the conditions are right for water banking, and you combine the transportation network of the State Water Project, you have potentially something much more valuable than wine grapes. And that's what we think is – it's in play right now. It hasn't happened yet, but I think that that's the next battle of privatization in this sector is going to be in the Paso area.
Well, thank you for the email. We have another one from Judy who says, I don't know the current status of this, but 1 or 2 years ago, a farmer in Kern County was trying to make a deal to sell water to a proposed development, a grossly inappropriate development on former salt ponds in San Francisco Bay that the Cargill Corporation is trying to build in Redwood City. Do you have any knowledge of this, and how does it relate to the water bank?
Yeah, I mean, this is the famous nickel water. This is water from the Kern River, and the developer was actually DMB Associates owns that rights to the water, and they were working with Tejon Ranch to develop projects on Tejon Ranch. They are also the developer of the Saltworks project in Redwood City, and so they were offering a portion of their water supply from that Kern River water to fuel the development in Redwood City. Absolutely true. They were going to basically ship the water north in the canal that goes south. You know, so they were going to use a series of water transfers and move the water, you know, replace, you know, hey, you're going to – you take this water instead. That person will take this water instead and kind of daisy chain a trade back up to the Bay Area. And so you had to look at it and say, wait a minute, this place is completely out of water. You have the last little bit of free-flowing river down there, and you're going to use it to grow a city up in the peninsula. This makes no sense. They have since – that water supply, that project in Redwood City has faltered largely because of the water supply issue, and rightly so, and because of the great activists, you know, in the Bay Area that have been fighting the development of the Bay. And so that's stalled. The developer has shifted their water, and they have now sold it to a development in the southern Kern County right at the Grapevine. It's called the Grapevine Development. And it's a massive new city that's going to go in right where that IKEA there's an IKEA distribution center on the left-hand side of the highway. On the east side of the highway, there's going to be a new city that's going to be built based on that water.
Adam Keats is an attorney with the Center for Food Safety, and he is featured in the new documentary, Water and Power, A California Heist. It airs on National Geographic. You can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org, and it reveals how private companies have rewritten the rules and seized control over California's water. And Adam, in the film, one of the farmers in Paso Robles says that this is a microcosm of what is happening around the globe. Can you talk about how this is being replicated in other parts of the world? Or is it?
Yes, definitely. It's definitely going on. There's a whole history of privatization efforts, for instance, in South America. There's, you know, whole countries and cities have converted their water systems largely to private water distribution companies and private water companies, and with, you know, riots that have followed because of, you know, people go without water. And in this country, there's been efforts to privatize municipal water supplies also. And I think Public Citizen, Food and Water Watch do a good job of talking about some of these things, and they have some research into this on a countrywide basis. But in terms of my focus, I mean, I have been pretty singularly focused in California, and it's a big system here, and there's a big game being played right here. So most of my attention has been here.
And we have an email from Julie who says, beyond watching the documentary, what can ordinary people do? Boycott the products? Write to our reps?
Yes and yes. And also I'd say a third thing is get involved, especially if you're in a place that has water districts that are not like, not in the urban area necessarily, if you can get in a place where you have any influence at all on your local water district, get involved in those local water politics. So if you live in some place like Paso Robles, or you live in, you know, Bakersfield or Fresno or something, or any place where you can get involved in your local water district in some way, for the most part, these districts are still nominally democratically elected, nominally, but they at least have some sort of level of public oversight. And so people, local activists should be getting involved in those.
Well, and what about politicians? Do they get this? Our representatives, David Chu is our assembly member, Scott Weiner just won his seat for state senate. Where do they stand on these issues?
I mean, I think for the most part, I think that most politicians view the water wars as being as obtuse and complicated and confusing as the rest of us do. They also view it mostly in terms of binary perspective, whether it's farms versus people or it's fish versus farms or something like that. And I don't think they quite are prepared to engage in the complexities of it. And also the money is very – there's a lot of money being thrown around. And so I think it's hard – if you're looking for your battle to fight, do you want to make enemies of, you know, big ag in California? They have a lot of power. And so you kind of pick your battles. Even good politicians choose not to engage in this because they don't want to make an enemy out of big ag.
But what major changes would you like to see?
I think I am very focused on returning the State Water Project to public control and returning it. It's not just public control. It's returning it to a equitable and sustainable system. The important thing to know about the Monterey Amendments back in the 90s is that not only do they concentrate power in the contractors, they shifted the management philosophy of that system from one that was based on a sustainable management model. So they actually had this thing called a firm yield. How much can the system supply? Let's make sure we don't promise more than that amount of water per year. And we'll make everyone do their planning based on that amount of water. And they shifted it to a variable yield supply, which was let's wheel and deal the stuff. Like, let's take the money off the gold standard. They took the water off the liquid standard in California. So we have this, like, water is now paper. It's just numbers on pieces of paper. And directly related to that is the collapse of the Delta ecosystem. So I think what we need to do is go back to recognizing the Delta is this ecosystem. What are the requirements for it? Everything up to that point has to be sacred. And then everything above that, let's talk about how we distribute that fairly and equitably.
How did that result in the collapse of the Delta ecosystem?
All the water in the north that's shipped to the south goes through the Delta. And so when you are only putting in – when you have a system built for 4.2 million acre feet, which is what they built, and they promise 4.28 million acre feet a year to all the users, and you're only sending 2 million acre feet down into the Delta, 2 million acre feet a year, but you're promising 4 million acre feet, there's going to be some – they're sucking more water out of the Delta than they're putting in is basically what it comes down to. And so they're dewatering the Delta, and they have been for 20, 30 years.
If control of the water bank was maintained by the state, what changes would we see?
The reality is, the State Department of Water Resources is so captured and controlled by these big ag interests that probably none, depressingly. But there is at least potential to change a state agency. There's a lot more potential to change a state agency than there is a local water district that's completely controlled by a private company.
What would it take to do this? Democrats now control the Assembly and the Senate.
Yeah, we need pressure. You know, we need political pressure on our elected officials to change the way the state agencies are being run and managed. And that's feasible. That's totally doable. No one has an interest in doing this kind of. I shouldn't say no one. I mean, other than people getting the water, but the rest of the state doesn't have an interest in this, and so it should be an achievable political goal to return the system to a sustainable system.
People who are concerned about the drought and water definitely have a stake in this.
Absolutely. I think one thing that's very interesting is that there's a big shift in. We talk about LA and the urban users. There's a big shift in their perspective. They are recognizing their role and the importance of their own sustainable water future. They are shifting over to the side of the environment and sustainability. Ag is slower, but I think that we might have some allies in San Diego and in Los Angeles on this battle.
And then, do you think if control of the water bank was maintained by the state, would we have seen thousands of California residents? Porterville got, I think, international attention because people were using bottled water to drink and bathe and cook with. Do you think that would have happened?
On a specific case, I don't know, but in general, it would not have happened. And the reason is because moving the Kern Water Bank to private control allowed the obscene planting of permanent nut trees in the southern San Joaquin Valley. And that meant that those trees, permanent crops, need water every year no matter how much water is falling. And so that created it hardened the demand on the water. It forced water to be sucked up by the trees year in and year out, year in and year out, which depleted the groundwater supplies, which taxed the system, which made the whole system unsustainable. Had they been growing row crops or even alfalfa or even something else, when the drought came, they could have stopped growing those crops and the water could have gone to the people instead.
And in the film, we meet people in Porterville. The documentary opens with Donna Johnson driving to the Drought Resource Center, where she loads her pickup truck with cases of bottled water. She says she spent the last 3.5 years delivering water to people in East Porterville. Over 1,000 wells have run dry in Tulare County. And Michael Lunsford is in the film, and he's in his kitchen telling people how he washes his dishes, how he flushes his toilet, how he showers. In some cases, there were ads on Craigslist saying, if you need a shower, give me $5 and I'll let you borrow my bathroom.
Right. I mean, I thought that was amazing.
This is in California.
Yeah. Yep. It felt like a third world country. And then you ask those guys, and all of us probably think, living in the city, why don't you just move? And you meet the lady, Carol Rowland, and she's like, you know, we're retirees. We don't have any income. And if we don't, how do you sell your house if it has no water? And you're stuck. They're trapped. They can't just – where are they going to move?
What is the status of water today in East Porterville? When it started raining and then raining and raining, I thought of these people in East Porterville.
Yeah.
What's the status?
Well, they are doing better in terms of trucking water into tanks that they're putting in front of people's homes, like this shown in the movie. But their water supply is still groundwater-based. And so the drought is not over in terms of groundwater. A lot of the water that's falling is flowing out to the ocean. The ground is saturated. It's not refilling the aquifers at the same rate that it's refilling our reservoirs. And so if you're in a groundwater-dependent area with a depleted aquifer, you are in just as much trouble now as you were 6 months ago.
Can you elaborate on that? Because we've had such a wet winter. It just rained over the weekend. What effect has this had on the drought?
Right. I mean, if you get surface water supplies, you're in pretty good shape. I mean, at least for right now. For this coming growing season, I'd say that everyone can grow whatever they want. I don't think there's going to be any restrictions on surface water-based growing in the state. But the aquifers are still incredibly damaged. The aquifers are still incredibly depleted. It would take years, decades to refill the aquifers. We need this type of weather for decades to refill some of the aquifers that we've depleted them so much.
What would it take to replenish groundwater supplies?
Groundwater supplies, same thing as aquifers. Yeah, so when I'm saying aquifers, this is the exact same thing. So the groundwater supplies are still in a critical state in this state. Most of the groundwater supplies are still in a critical state, regardless of the amount of water that we're getting this year.
What do you think it would take?
You mean amount of water?
If we had this sort of rainy winter for the next 5 years...
I think we'd be in better shape in 5 years if we had this kind of rain. Does anyone think we're going to have this kind of rain for 5 years? Like, no way. This is a blip. I mean, I think most models say we're in a state of drought with occasional massive floods. And that's not good for groundwater. That's good for reservoirs, for above ground storage, but it's not good for below ground storage.
And can you talk a little bit about just this fight that we have seen play out between sort of people talking about almonds, people talking about dairy, because this is the number two dairy state in the country, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's very water intensive, mm-hmm. that industry. And then almonds, there's a distinction. If they're grown in the desert, they are far more water intensive than if they're grown sustainably in other parts of the state.
Right. I think that the critical thing is location. I mean, you have your location, your connection to your water. Where's your water coming from and whether it's sustainable or not? And I do have a lot of problems with alfalfa growing in California, with cotton growing. Just because I focus on almonds doesn't mean that the rest of the crops in the world are scot-free.
In some cases, alfalfa is being grown here and then shipped to China and Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely.
To feed their dairy cows.
Yeah. Now, in a weird way, that situation over there by the Colorado River, the alfalfa might be the best thing to be grown right there. Because you know what? They're flood irrigating that with Colorado River water, which means a lot of it goes back into the river system and actually might have a chance of flowing to Mexico. So you got to be careful about making blanket statements about any crop. Mm-hmm. And these guys love to fight each other. They love to try to pit the cows versus the almonds versus the meat. And they're broad strokes, but it really is very specific to the place. One thing I can say for certain is that we should not be having any permanent tree crops, citrus, nuts, grapes, in the southern San Joaquin Valley. It is inappropriate for that region, for that climate, for that soil, for their water supply. And doing it is irresponsible.
Does the wonderful company, which is owned by the Resniks, have the majority stake in those trees?
I don't know if they are. I would say my guess is yes, but I'm not certain about that. They are definitely the biggest player in that region, and they control everything ripples away from them in that region.
And what else can average citizens do about this? We're going to do a show about California and climate change and how under a Trump administration, individual choices are becoming much more important.
Yeah, I think so. I think purchasing power, and I think that what people do with what they buy, I think is very important. And I wish I had a better answer in terms of almonds right now. I think people are developing it. People are working on it. But we're not quite there. With some crops, we do have boycottable crops. We do have abilities to look at stuff and say this is grown in the wrong place. And I think people need to be starting to look at that.
And then what can people do if they want to work on ensuring that the public regains and maintains control of the state's water supply?
Yeah, again, I'd say focus on your local water district. Get involved with organizations like my organization. There's also a group called the California Water Information Network, CWIN. That's a great group doing this in the Santa Barbara area in Southern California. And there's Aqua Alliance up in Chico. There is Restore the Delta in the middle part of the country and in the Bay Area. There are a number of groups that are involved in water politics on the good side. Generally, the ones focusing on this issue are the smaller groups. The larger groups are less active on this specific issue on privatization in California than I'd like them to be. So take a look and see what those groups are involved in and support those groups.
And people running to be the next governor are throwing their hats in the ring. It seems like this should be an issue in that race.
I think it ought to be. I mean, Jerry Brown was going to be untouchable on this. He's totally on board with this infrastructure, but the next governor should not be.
Totally on board.
Yeah. Oh, he absolutely on board. He's not a friend on this issue at all, unfortunately.
Adam Keats is an attorney with the Center for Food Safety. He is featured in the new documentary, Water and Power, A California Heist. It reveals how private companies rewrote the rules and seized control over the state's water supply. It'll air on National Geographic, and you can watch the trailer at yourcallradio.org. Adam, thanks for your work. Thanks for coming in.
Right on. Thanks, Rose. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
We've been listening to a rebroadcast of Your Call, the documentary discussed today, Water and Power, A California Heist, will re-air on National Geographic Sunday, June 25th at 8 p.m. Pacific Time. Tomorrow on Your Call, how does the pretrial and bail bond system embolden predatory practices? Of the approximately 700,000 people in jail on any given day in the United States, more than 60% have not been sentenced. The majority of prisoners in local jails are serving time because they can't afford to pay the pretrial bail bond. Since the 1980s, pretrial detentions have far outpaced the number of individuals actually serving sentences. Join the conversation on the Next Your Call tomorrow at 10 a.m. with Renee Kemp and you. Your Call is produced at KLW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Rose Aguilar hosted today's show, and Laura Flynn produced it. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Thanks again for listening. This is Your Call.